Okay, let's see if this is recording. This is recording, so we'll be able to carry on. Before beginning today's lecture, I wanted to just repeat one very last bit from the previous lecture on the media. Just to be sure, the particular idea that I suggested at the end of the lecture as a way of moving us towards a more vibrant democratic media system. So the particular device that I was discussing was clear. So just to remind you what the problem is, a serious democracy requires a very well-informed, vigorously informed citizenry. That's what I refer to as a democratic media, a media that serves to create vitality in a democracy. Understood in that way, the media is a public good. It's not just a source of private consumption. It's not just entertainment. It's a public good because it makes our whole environment of public life function in a better way, if we have the right kind of media system. Then the problem is that a media system that's dominated by profit-maximizing commercial firms is unlikely to serve that particular public function. Not because commercial media are malevolent, it's not really because of any bad faith on their part, it's simply because it's not their priority. The priority of a profit-maximizing media system is to maximize profits. So we need, at least as a serious component of our media system, a publicly spirited, publicly oriented process of producing particularly informational media. So this is especially salient around the issue of journalism and the news. We need that kind of media to be a vibrant and important part of our media system. Then the question is, how do you do it? One model is to have state-run public media. But that has all sorts of disadvantages. And it's a set of disadvantages that make people in a liberal society very nervous. The state controlling the media, well, that gets to sound a lot like something vulnerable to propaganda. So what we need is a device by which public money can be channeled into a public interest media without the state controlling that media. We need public money, our collective resources, to be channeled in that way, but without giving centralized authority power over the media. That's the trick. One way of doing this would be simply to create nonprofit media organizations and have people make charitable contributions to it, which they could count as tax deductions, right? That's what's called tax expenditures. That's the way we fund the arts, museums, symphonies. Universities get a lot of funding that way. Churches do. That's how we have public support of religion in the United States, is primarily through people making charitable donations and then getting a tax write-off for it. That would be one device, but the problem with that device is it means the richer you are, the more you are in a position to influence the media. Because you get the biggest tax deductions, but also because you have the most to give. And that also violates, in the case of the media, a central principle of democracy. That is the principle of equality of citizens. So simple charitable contributions to nonprofit media backed by tax expenditures, tax deductions, goes part of the way of getting public money into a democratic media, but it does so in a way that violates the principle of equal citizenship. So the alternative is to give everybody who files taxes a voucher, in effect. It's called a non-refundable tax credit. You get allocated to you $200 a year. If you don't spend it, it just goes back to the government, so you can't pocket it. It's not a tax deduction. It's simply an allocation of $200 of your taxes to a particular purpose. We already have that for a couple of very small things. So if some of you have filed your own tax returns, so you have gone through and checked off boxes, you'll see that there's this little box for donating. It's some tiny amount, a dollar perhaps. I don't remember what the amount is, to a political campaign fund. If you don't check off the box, you don't get the money back. It's just that you're allocating a dollar of your taxes for that purpose. That's the way I think a publicly interested nonprofit media system should be funded. Every citizen who files taxes can allocate, and I'm saying $200 a year, that's an arbitrary figure. You'd have to really think through how much this should be, to non-commercial media who satisfy some kind of public interest criterion. Now, those criteria would be controversial. You'd have to figure it out. You'd want them to be as open as possible. You would certainly want them not to be ideologically biased. This is not an argument for how can we get more money into the kind of media I personally like. It's how can we get more money into the publicly interested collective democratic media. A non-refundable tax credit, I think, is a good device for combining centralized acquisition of resources and decentralized citizen allocation of those resources. You see why that's a really attractive combination. You know, it gives us the advantage of scale, having the state be able to gather the resources, and the advantages of democratic decentralization, letting citizens decide where the resources go. I think that would be the ideal way by which a democratic media could be funded. And that's called a non-refundable tax credit. That's the lingo for that kind of proposal. Okay, today, a difficult topic, militarism. This is difficult in lots of ways. It's certainly controversial. I would say probably the most heated passions around any of the issues of controversy we've explored this semester, the most heated passions occur around issues of the military. More so even than questions of social welfare, poverty, class inequality, the weakness of democracy, all those things, of course, are controversial. Nothing sparks deep controversy and passion as much as debates around military issues. When I taught this course in 2002, a long time ago, in the run-up to the Iraq War, which was a very heated moment in American politics, the class was just in a kind of uproar over these issues. There was very deep divisions. Most students were, I think, skeptical about the impending Iraq War, but there were some who were very strongly supportive. And that actually created the deepest and most and angriest confrontations that I've had in class around these issues. And the problem, I think, is that the idea of the military, it taps into such different moral sentiments. On the one hand, the actual people who do the work of the military, the soldiers who fight, put themselves on the line and are worthy of the deepest respect and the deepest honoring. And that's the kind of way, as a community, we collectively relate to the military because of the individual heroism and sacrifice which people are called upon to do in the context of military activity. On the other hand, there is almost no more devastating source of human suffering than military conflict. If you think of the various scourges of humanity that create socially produced human suffering, it's hard to rate anything as worse than warfare. So war is a blight on humanity and has been, of course, throughout the history of civilization. But it's also a site of our most heroic myths. And that's a pretty combustible combination of sentiment. The worst things that people do to each other combined with the most glorious things people can achieve. That's, you know, powerfully, palpably fraught with emotion, passion, and human concern. So I take a very critical view of what I'm calling militarism. just as I take a critical view of many aspects of capitalism. But that should not be interpreted as a critical view of the integrity and honor of any particular people who serve within this kind of apparatus. And therefore, the whole discussion is fraught in this way. Much depends, of course, upon what your view is as to what purposes our military fulfills. The conventional view, the conventional view by Americans, most Americans, I think, about war and peace and the American military, is that we use our military power to defend freedom and defend democracy, to protect America, but not to dominate other people and other countries. We are defenders, not aggressors. We have a Department of Defense, not a Department of Aggression. We have a Department of Defense, not a Department of War. The dominant view of American military is that it's not merely serving our national interest in some nefarious way. It's not just that it's serving to dominate because that's good for America. Rather, the dominant view is that the American military is a reluctant defender of peace, security, and freedom. Now, if that were really true, if the American military was, as its primary function in the world today, serving to protect us as a people, not to protect certain interests of certain groups of us, but to protect us as a community, as a collectivity, then the purposes that the military serve would not be in tension with these values of honor and respect for the sacrifices of people who serve in the military. The problem comes when you look and criticize the purposes to which the military serves. Almost nobody says we shouldn't have national defense, that is, we shouldn't have a capacity to repel and protect ourselves from attack. So even, except for some very small groups of absolute pacifists, most critics of American military still believe in national defense. The question is whether or not our military serves purposes that go way, way beyond that narrow compass. Here's the basic reality. We spend vastly more than any other country in the world on the military, by orders of magnitude. We spend roughly half of the total global budget on military spending is spent by one country, the United States. We use military threats and intervention as a central instrument of foreign policy, including overthrowing democratically elected governments. We use the military proactively, not just reactively, to be sure that our interests dominate, even if that means overthrowing democratically elected governments. And our domestic affairs are severely affected by the global role of our military. We have, I will argue, a heavily militarized economy, not merely a military within a capitalist economy. We have a militarized economy. Let me just present some quick data. This is all, or at least most of this is in the book, but it's just to illustrate the basic point. Here's, in 2008, the global spending on military, how it's divided between different countries. You see the United States spends 48% of the total global spending on military. If you add Europe to that, our allies, we're getting over two-thirds of the global spending. We have military bases stretching all over the world. The British like to say in the height of the British Empire that the sun never sets on the British Empire. The sun never sets on American military bases. There is always an American military base in sunshine, as it were. interventions. This is a list that's in the book. I won't read down it. This is a list of interventions since World War II. The ones in yellow here are ones where actual American troops were physically on the ground. The ones not are cases where we supported through the use of military, but not through the use of our own troops, military actions. So in Cuba in 1961, we supported the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. Logistically, we provided the equipment and so on, but American troops were not themselves involved in that invasion. If we look at the impact on military spending as a proportion of federal spending in the United States, if you define total military spending as including the interest payments on debts incurred from previous wars, so if you go into debt, we went into huge debt, for example, to fund the Iraq War and the Afghan War. One way of counting what our total military spending is to include the interest payments on those debts as part of military spending, not just the out-of-pocket, direct, immediate expenditures. 44% of all government spending, by this calculation, in 2009 went to the military. Only 11% went to anti-poverty programs in the United States. All anti-poverty programs, which would include things like unemployment insurance, food stamps, Medicaid, and other. Well, I think Medicaid may be part of health care in this particular calculation. Whoops, too fast. So what is militarism? How am I going to use this expression? Here's my formal definition. Militarism is a political and ideological orientation towards international affairs in which three things are present. First, the threat and use of military power is a central strategy of international policy. It's a central component of how you conduct yourself in the world is to use threats and use of military power. Second, the military plays a pervasive role in the internal economic and political life of a country. Debates over the use of military are important. The location of military contracts are important. The use of social networks to get military contracts for particular corporations are important. The military plays a pervasive role in the internal economic and political life of a country. And military preparedness is the highest priority of government policy. If there's a debate over whether to spend more on the military or on domestic programs, and you're in a period of budget constraints where something has to go, you'll sacrifice programs to help the poor in order to protect programs to maintain military strength. Understood in this way, militarism is an institution. It's not a policy. There is virtually no difference between Republicans and Democrats on this issue. It may be that in some particular administration, this militaristic view of public policy is stronger than in others. We recently lived in the first the first decade of the 21st century, a particularly intense period of militaristic domestic and foreign policy. But that really shouldn't be identified with militarism as such. Militarism is broadly defended by both major political parties. What it means to say that it's an institution is that it's deeply embedded in our economic, political, and social structures and institutions. It creates a broad range of interests of corporations, workers, politicians, military personnel, and others, a broad range of interests that interlock to support this as a system. Millions of American workers' jobs depend upon militarism. They are part of a coalition that supports military spending. This renders militarism a system and not simply a policy. Now, of course, there are policies connected to it, policies in the sense of particular laws, particular debates, particular issues of budget allocation. Of course, there are policies connected to it. But it's a mistake to see this as just a public policy issue. It's institutionalized. It's part of the way the system as a whole functions. Let me now just really briefly give you an account of the historical trajectory of American militarism. So to understand where we are now, it's useful, I think, to look at the role of the military in American society from the founding of the United States to the present and how it's evolved. Again, in the book, there's more details about this. I'll touch on this rather lightly. Let me begin with just a few quotes from the founding of the Republic. At the founding, there was really a lot of skepticism about the role of the military. Our first president was a military officer, George Washington. But Washington was not a big fan of the military. He wrote, "An overgrown military establishments are, under any form of government, inauspicious to liberty and are to be regarded as particularly hostile to Republican liberty." George Washington expressing quite a lot of skepticism about the role of the military. James Madison, another of the august founding fathers, "Of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes, and armies, debts, and taxes are the known instrument for bringing the many under the domination of the few." And 200 years later, Eisenhower expressed the same worry, and I would like to just play for you Eisenhower's famous inaugural speech. I'll just play the bit that's about the military. Here we go.
"Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk the emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportion. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must constantly guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberty or democratic process. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizen can compel the proper dimensioning of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals.
So that was Dwight Eisenhower in 1961. His fears and warnings went largely unheeded, and our military spending is much greater today than it was at the time that he spoke of the dangers of the military-industrial complex. And note in his speech, this was his farewell address just before John F. Kennedy was inaugurated in January of 1961. Note that he included in his dangers reference to the spiritual health of our communities. He said that in passing. What he was portraying was a problem that penetrates the very fabric of the society and distorts our priorities and distorts our sense of who we are. It penetrates every state house, I think he went on to say. And this was in 1961. Militarism as a central feature of our social structure and our institutions has, if anything, grown since then. So let's continue this brief, very brief and rapid tour through the history of how we came to this situation. The 19th century was characterized by what I think could be called an ambivalence about military. The worry about standing armies was present, but it confronted another core American idea, the importance of military power for the conquest of lands in North America itself. So we had this problem. There was the nervousness about standing armies. George Washington's sentiment was very widely spent, very widely held. But there was also this desire to conquer the lands that were occupied by indigenous people in North America. This became crystallized in the doctrine of manifest destiny. I imagine most of you have encountered that expression in various history courses you took in high school. Manifest destiny. The belief that the United States, which was then on the eastern part of North America, had a natural right to expand westward to the Pacific Ocean, that this was our destiny. And in the context of the kind of ideologies and cultural understandings of the era, I think one should understand manifest destiny as very close to believing it was a divine destiny. This was something that God had given us as our natural purpose to conquer and move westward, which of course meant displacing other human beings. It was not the case that the continent was unpopulated. So military power was essential for the expansion westward, and therefore, in spite of the objection to standing armies, there was a need, if you wanted to pursue that goal, of having a permanently established, if still relatively unprofessional, military force. This became particularly acute in the Mexican War of 1848. It's one of the wars in American history that's not given a lot of study. Most of you, I'm sure, encountered it. You know about the Alamo. Remember the Alamo? Davy Crockett, all that wonderful mythology we have about it. What's not usually understood is that the Mexican War was a war of aggression, of conquest. The United States invaded Mexico. We were the aggressors in that war, and we did it for purposes of conquering and taking over the land that was previously legally and internationally recognized as part of the territory of a different country. The Mexican War was also, and even more problematically, I think, a war over slavery. So this is also something not generally known. The Mexican government banned slavery in the Texas province of Mexico. Texas was part of Mexico at that point. They banned slavery. American settlers were moving into Texas and they wanted slavery there. One of the motivations for the Mexican War was to allow slavery in Mexico. That adds an added kind of moral blight. We not only fought an aggressive war to conquer land of another country and incorporate it in our own territory, we did so at least in part under the motivations of the expansion of slavery in the South. Still, the Mexican War did not result in the creation of a well-established, professionalized standing army. And neither really did the Civil War. Now, you might have thought the Civil War, which came in the middle of the 19th century, you might have thought that the Civil War, which was this horrendous mass mobilization in both the North and the South of huge armies and fantastically high numbers of casualties, you might have thought that in the aftermath of the Civil War there would have been established a large standing professional army in the United States. But that really didn't happen. After the Civil War was over, there was a very rapid demobilization and a decline of kind of military culture in the United States. The next really important episode in the consolidation of a permanent military establishment, therefore, was not really the Civil War itself. I don't mean to minimize its importance in American history. I'm just saying, with respect to this problem, how did we end up with such a powerful military establishment as part of our institutional structure? The next important episode for that really comes in the Spanish-American War. This is what launched American militarism on a global scale. The Mexican War was a war in North America against our immediate neighbor to acquire land. And in one sense, the Mexican War could be thought of as just part of the general expansion of the United States westward. And it just happened that that particular territory was under the boundaries of another country, whereas the Plains Indians in Minnesota, Wisconsin, well, more Minnesota than the Dakotas, that wasn't another country, it was just Native Americans. So the Mexican War and our displacement of Native Americans from their land in the rest of North America, they kind of go together as a similar move westward. The conquest of the Philippines is a different story entirely. The Spanish-American War is the first case where you really have the American military functioning on a large global scale in a way that many people would describe as imperialism, not merely warfare. The Philippine resistance to American occupation of the Philippines was protracted. It led to a very bitter and violent period, 1901 to 1903, in which it's estimated that 200,000 Filipinos were killed by American soldiers. Filipinos who were resisting the American occupation. The Philippine resistance initially welcomed the United States in helping to overthrow the Spanish, but they did not do so in the spirit of wanting themselves to become a colony of the United States, and therefore they resisted it. The Spanish, war of repression against the Filipinos, 1901 to 1903, I suspect that is not something covered in most high school. How many of you in your high school history read anything in any detail about the 1901 to 1903 resistance to the American occupation of the Philippines with 200,000 Philippine deaths? So a few of you have encountered that. It was ideologically defended on racial and cultural grounds, that we had a superior culture, that we would be bringing freedom to the Filipinos, and that this resistance needed to be crushed because it would simply lead to barbarism in the population. That was really an important escalation of the American sense of what our role in the world was and what the role for the American military was. Some historians have argued, and I'm not an historian and I haven't studied these things in detail, but Some historians have argued that the Japanese emperor and the Japanese government in the early 20th century saw the American imperial machine and how successfully it had subdued the Philippines and took it as an object lesson for how they should behave in their efforts at expansion in the same region. I don't by any means mean to suggest that the United States invasion of the Philippines and destruction of the Philippine resistance explains Japanese imperialism, but I do mean to suggest that it's not fundamentally different in its character. Its fundamental purpose was to dominate and control through military force the people and economies of other places. Before the Spanish-American War, the American military establishment was really very amateurish. It was a disorganized, not heavily bureaucratized, not heavily professionalized apparatus. In the period leading up to World War I, there occurred really the first efforts to seriously bureaucratize and modernize the military. The spirit of the American military before then was much more the spirit of militias, where if there was an emergency, you would rapidly mobilize people and train them, that there would be enough basic skills in the population from hunting and other activities that those skills could be ramped up for purposes of military combat, but that you wouldn't have a large number of people whose whole professional life and careers were oriented towards the military. That began to change in a significant way in the run-up to World War I. World War I, I think, should be seen as the really decisive turning point. You know, each of these episodes, the Spanish-American War, the Mexican War, and so on, each of them provide lessons for subsequent actors as they attempt to build these institutions. World War I really launched most of the components of the modern military institutions in the United States. World War I also deepened the sense of military power as part of what Chalmers Johnson, an important political scientist who was actually a very strong supporter of the Cold War. He's considered one of the architects, the ideological architects of the Cold War, but later became highly critical of American militarism. World War I, in his view, was the place where this notion of the American military as part of ideological crusades, that the United States had ideological crusades which we pursued and used the military as its means. That World War I really consolidated this. Woodrow Wilson was a crucial architect of the idea of warfare and the military as an instrument of ideological crusades. There had been bits of this before, as I mentioned in the Philippine invasion and conquest. There were ideological justifications, and indeed Manifest Destiny had a whole ideological face to it. But World War I really brought this home. It was fought under two big slogans, the war to end all wars and making the world safe for democracy. Those were the two big slogans of World War I. Now, on the one hand, ideological slogans are just a way of justifying warfare that one does for other reasons, but I don't think it should be dismissed as pure window dressing. Ideological crusades have a life of their own. They generate passions. They deepen the sense of moral righteousness in the cause, and they tend to blind populations to the complexities of policy. Ideological crusades become motivations for militarism, not merely after-the-fact justifications. And we've certainly seen that in recent years. The war in Iraq, for example, was waged as an ideological crusade. There were attempts to justify it on the grounds of there being weapons of mass destruction, which we know did not exist we know now, and many people at the time said did not exist, but it was waged and sustained under the banners of ideological crusades. This has become a permanent feature of American foreign policy and of militarism. Now, after World War I, there was substantial demilitarization. We had not yet become a militarized economy. There was huge demobilization right after World War I and a dismantling of much of the productive capacity that had been oriented and geared towards the war. When the 1930s began, we did not have an armaments industry of any size at all. We were not an exporter of military hardware. We were an exporter of steel, but not of military machines. And we did not have a substantial militarized economy, even though we then did have a fully professionalized military institution. World War II and the Cold War are what turned this military orientation towards global policy, which was already present and cemented by these ideological crusades, really turned that into a militarized, into full bore militarization, militarism. World War II was by far the greatest military mobilization in American history. After the war, there was some expectation of demilitarization. As the war came to an end in 1945, there was great hopes that there would be a massive reduction of military spending, and that as a result of that, there would be lots of resources available for other kinds of public purposes. The Cold War ended that possibility. And the result of the Cold War is that more than half a century of military budgets, and it's 67 years now since the end of World War II, so almost two-thirds of a century of military budgets have been over $300 billion a year in current dollars, and often over $400 billion. Here's the shape of the military budget since 1950 in current dollars. So this is $209, and since there's been very little inflation in the past 3 years, this wouldn't have to be adjusted much to be accurate today. You can see that in terms of actual spending, the level of our military spending today is the highest it's ever been since the end of World War II. Higher than during the Korean War, higher than during the Vietnam War. Those are the peaks. This peak here is a very peculiar peak. This corresponds to the Vietnam War. This corresponds to the Korean War. This corresponds to the war on terrorism, the Iraq War and the Afghan War. But look at this. This is this huge, massive expansion of the military in the 1980s. It didn't correspond to any war. That was the huge military buildup during the Reagan administration in a period where the United States did not face any global conflicts of any scale. The military budget, high military budgets, have become a pervasive and permanent feature of the American state and the American economy. Whoops. You'd think by this time in the semester I would know how to control this thing. What are the effects of 65 years of interventions and military spending? Defense contracts are the single most important way that the government intervenes in the economy, providing jobs, research, technical change, and economic stimulation. The livelihood of millions of Americans depends upon military spending. That's really important to remember. The United States intervenes in the economy of the United States in a massive way, but in a very narrow way. It consistently intervenes in the economy through massive military spending. Ultimately, such military spending depends on war. In the absence of war, it's almost impossible to maintain over a very long period huge military spending. So the deep dependency of the economy on militarism itself promotes militarism. The economy depends upon massive military spending. In the current debates over the debt and this so-called fiscal cliff that we're facing, if there's no agreement between the White House and Congress by January 1st, one of the aspects of this fiscal cliff that is of great concern is that it will result in massive cuts in military spending. And people say, and that will cause great economic harm. It may also cause harm to the military, that's a separate matter, but part of the problem is you have massive cuts in military spending, you do massive harm to the economy. Military spending is one of the key ways that our economy provides jobs, but you can only really sustain that in the very long term if you have military conflicts. Massive military spending also almost inevitably breeds corruption. I say almost inevitably. I don't want to be mechanical about it and say that if you have massive military spending, you will always have a corrupt process by which those resources are allocated. But it's pretty tough to control corruption when you have this scale of military spending. And the reason is that military contracts are shrouded in secrecy under the shield of national security and classified information. It's almost impossible to have transparent monitoring of military spending. It's just a chronic problem. I should say the United States in these terms is remarkably uncorrupt given the scale of the contracts involved. You know, you'd think this would, in many places in the world, this scale of government contracts that are shielded from the light of day, that are not transparent, that are not subject to public review in the ordinary way. In many parts of the world, this would lead to just massive bribery and back-scratching and people individually getting payoffs for contracts. There are scandals like that in the U.S. It does happen from time to time. I think it's actually somewhat of an achievement of American honesty that the system is not deeply corrupt in that sense. But nevertheless, having an economy dependent upon government spending of closed contracts hidden from public view is a recipe for having an economy which at its core is built around relatively corrupt kinds of relations. The 21st century, what are the prospects? There was much talk in the 1990s of a peace dividend. At the end of the Cold War, there was hope that military spending could be permanently scaled back to the level of a purely defensive posture. We would not have to be so aggressive internationally if we didn't have to fear a counterforce from a global enemy. Those hopes died with 9/11 and the war on terrorism. The last 10 years have led to an intensification, not a reduction of previous militarism. Well, how should we explain all this in the world today? How should we explain the motivations for militarism? This raises the problem that sometimes goes under the expression empire. Should the United States be regarded as an imperial nation that has a global empire? That's one way of thinking about it. And if not, what are the alternatives? Now, I think this is actually a pretty complex issue. I like to say that a lot, right, this semester. I keep invoking complexity as a theme you have to keep in mind. And sometimes critics of American militarism, critics like myself, are accused of having very simple-minded views, conspiracy theories, explaining all sorts of things about American policy. I think there is a lot of complexity in this process. There's no single overriding factor or motive that explains the existence of militarism. The way to think about this is that there are many different kinds of motivations that underwrite the people who support such policies and the people in power who support them. But that support is able to be sustained over time because it constitutes a system. That's what an institutionalized system means. The very meaning of a system is a set of interlocking motivations that fit together in such a way that it becomes very difficult to challenge the functioning of the system as a whole. Difficult to challenge because if you are successful in challenging one of these motivational bases, there are still plenty of others in play to keep the system of relationships going. Let me then briefly review five motivations that typically get raised as the motivations behind American militarism, motivations which collectively constitute the basis of the system, no one of which would be sufficient, and no one of which has in any necessary way prime importance. So I'm not ranking these, I'm just laying these out as motivations that underpin this particular system. The first is the issue of narrow economic interests. By narrow economic interests, I mean really crude things. The United States intervenes in a particular country because there are very specific economic interests at stake in that country. In the earlier part of the 20th century, we periodically would send gunboats to countries in Central America because United Fruit had interests there, and those interests were threatened. That was called gunboat diplomacy. And the countries that we interfered with militarily under that rubric were called banana republics. And the invocation of the banana as the metaphor was literal, because those were republics that actually produced bananas, United Fruit, being grounded in banana production. So sometimes military interventions are really driven by that kind of crude, direct economic interest. In the present period, many people have argued that this is the case for oil, that if Iraq did not have any oil, we wouldn't have bothered. It was by virtue of the oil interests in the Middle East that American foreign policy is directed towards securing those oil resources, and when necessary, to do so through military intervention. Now, while I think it's an oversimplification to say, why did we have the Iraq War? Because of oil. It's certainly the case that a good deal of our military interventions in the last 15 years occurred in areas in which oil interests were extremely important. Here's a series of slides that show this. This is the configuration before the oil, before the Middle Eastern wars of the last decade or so. The yellow areas are where there was an American military present. The oil derricks are where there's oil. That's 1989. Here's 1991, after the first Gulf War. Here's 1999, after the Yugoslav interventions. Here's 2001 after the Afghan War, and here is 2003 after the Iraq War. Some people argue that the bases are built to wage wars, or are wars waged to build bases. So whatever else one says, there certainly is a correlation between the presence of American military intervention in this period and certain particular kinds of economic interests. Second motivation, the maintenance of general global economic dominance of American-based multinational corporations. This is a broader issue than just specific narrow economic interests in particular places. Large American corporations have investments all over the world, and American military power has often been used to just demonstrate that there are consequences to countries when those interests are threatened, rather than to support the interests of any particular corporation in any particular place. In the 1950s, we overthrew elected governments in Guatemala and Iran because of direct threats to American corporations who were already there. Whoops. Now, why did it suddenly ask me about that? Impatient computer. Taken together, these two motivations, the first and second, taken together, this is what's usually meant by imperialism. So when you hear people saying the United States is imperialist, using that word, imperialist, what they're referring to is this couplet of motivations, that the military is used directly to serve particular interests and more broadly to serve the global interests of American multinational global capitalism. The third motivation is national security. Now, this is certainly important. I wouldn't for a moment say that one of the motivations and certainly one of the justifications for having a standing army and a military and an established military is precisely national defense. However, there are deep disagreements about whether militarism is mainly a matter of defense rather than the aggressive pursuit of national interests. If it was just national defense, I don't think the scale of American military would be anything like what it is today. And note, this isn't just a kind of left-wing position. One of the Republican candidates in the last primary season, who was strongly supported by the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, Ron Paul, he argued that the American military should be cut by two-thirds, that we should have no bases anywhere outside the U.S., and that the purpose of the American military should be exclusively to defend our borders, not to defend our interests abroad, just to defend our borders. He took a position very similar to what I would take in terms of scaling back the American military, and he was somebody who at least some wings of the Tea Party liked, and certainly the libertarian wing of the Republican Party liked. I didn't like his domestic proposals, which was to stop helping anybody live better lives, but his foreign policy proposals seemed basically sound. And for the fundamentally the same kind of reason that I object to these foreign policy uses of military, that it distorts our economy, it distorts our democracy, and it's using the military for purposes other than defending our country. Fourth motivation, the distinctive interests of the military-industrial complex itself. Now, this is where the story gets really systemic, where all the pieces begin to lock together into a cohesive whole, which makes it, of course, tougher to do anything about. This is what helps explain the widespread popular support for the military, even when we're not under any military threat. Cuts in military programs hurt powerful corporations, workers, and communities. And this means that there's a coalition of political forces prepared to support military spending, even if they don't have any interests in what the military does. They just have an interest in the military existing in the form it does. To justify such budgets, you need threats. So if you're going to be a coalition to support large military spending because it's in your direct interests, you need to portray the world as a scary place. And you often find liberal Democrats playing this game just as much as conservative Republicans. That's why this is not a partisan issue. You have liberal Democrats supporting submarine bases in Connecticut, that were designed in the Cold War to deal with the global submarine threat of the Soviet Union. We don't need massive production of new submarines and aircraft carriers if our only purpose is national defense. But if your jobs of your constituents depend upon it, and if the stimulus to your local economies depend upon it, and if there's no other way to get that stimulus, then you support military spending. Exaggerating military threats is thus a constant strategy to maintain military spending. One way to think about this is that militarism underwrites a politics of fear rather than a politics of hope. A politics of fear about the world rather than a politics of aspiration for the kind of world we want. Alternative to ways to spend money to stimulate the economy to support jobs are, of course, possible. I've argued for that at various times of the course. We could be spending these resources on domestic infrastructure, on education, on all sorts of other amenities that would make life better for people. There's plenty of other ways we can spend money to support jobs. The problem with these alternative ways of spending money is that they open the door for this broader idea of an affirmative state, that it's a legitimate function of the state to help people and to provide for the public good. And if you're opposed to that but still want to have the government supporting jobs, the military is the right way to go, because that's a separate, cordoned off, distinct sphere of activity that you can defend without having to defend all the other public purposes for which an affirmative state might be used. Finally, as a motivation, there is still ideological crusades. The precise character of the crusades changes from time to time, but its core is the belief that the United States has a divine mission to spread its values and way of life around the world. Not just because it's in our narrow interest to do so, but because it's the right thing to do. Or even in the strongest form, because it's God's work that we're doing when we do spread our values and way of life around the world. This ideology of crusades continues to be important. Just one more brief moment. In the Bush administration's national security document, the official statement of what our purposes in the world were, the Bush administration wrote, and I quote, "There is a single sustainable model for national success that is right and true for every person in every society. The United States must defend liberty and justice because these principles are right and true for all people everywhere." And liberty and justice meant liberty and justice as we conceive it. This is crusading ideology, and it's probably not the driving motivation for militarism, but it certainly helps to cement the political support for it. On Thursday, I'll just wrap up this lecture, and then we'll discuss unions. See you then.